The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Exploring solutions to the mental health crisis. This is Mind Medicine on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And good afternoon. It's Sam Muscat standing in here for Charles Kovas. And what a pair of big shoes I've got to fill in for the next 2 hours. My background, very briefly, is an industrial relations specialist, and I've had the opportunity of dealing with a number of issues right through my whole career, especially when we talk about mind medicine, about mental health. Now, I'm not the expert like Charles is, but I'm going to give it the best shot that I can today. And I have a real great guest with me, a special guest who's going to embrace us for the next couple of hours and join us for the next couple of hours. And it's Tunde Mikkel, is an Australian registered consultant and counselling physician, and who lives in Ballarat, a regional city around 120 kilometres west of Melbourne. And as a psychologist, she does a magic job. I've known Tunde for a number of years, and I've interviewed her in another place, and it's great. Good afternoon to you, Tunde.
Hello, Sam. Lovely to be with you again.
Yeah, it is.
Hope the sun's shining where you are.
Well, it is. And is it raining in Ballarat?
Actually, right now, no. But that was very different yesterday. So I'm really enjoying a bit of sunshine.
I've got to say to you, Tunde, and I'll share this with the listeners, that I'm a little bit nervous. So hence the reason for even couldn't think of the psychologist in you. So I do apologise. But look,
fine.
It's great to have you join me, and I cannot say thank you enough. And the subject today that you and I are going to have, well, one of the subjects, and I'm sure we will cross a number of subjects, but one of the subjects we're going to start off with is with organisational behaviour. Coaching managers to apply simple but powerful organisational principles in their enterprise. However, before we do that, Tunde, can you just tell us a little bit about your background? Because I've got to say, I've read your bio, and you know what? I didn't even recognize all the things that you have done. So thank you for serving the community also, as you have.
Oh, thank you, Sam. I won't read through it all, but just in a nutshell, I've been a psychologist for a number of decades, but I've also been an educator, a qualified educator, for many decades as well, right across the spectrum from primary school children right through to postgraduate. I've taught, and psychology is really one of the threads of my life. Human behaviour, the human condition, and understanding all of its intricacies, and I keep learning more every day. And education is really probably the major theme of my life. I really enjoy and relish the opportunities to bring knowledge to people that, but maybe in a form they haven't been able to access before. So, you know, days like today or sessions like this are great opportunities to try to frame information and knowledge which we gather in the academic world to bring those to closer to where people could use them.
Yeah, and but you know, as I said to you, Tunde, too, although you didn't touch on it, and I think you should, because you've done a magic job in even serving the community as a firefighter with the Country Fire Authority. When I think of all of the major fires that we've had over the many years, and the work that you've done, and the work that our Country Fire Authority personnel and our emergency services personnel does, you can't leave that. So thank you again for your service. And also thank you. I was intrigued, Army and Navy.
Yes, yes. I've served both in the Army Reserve and the Naval Reserve, and I've been full-time Army as well.
Wow.
For a patch of time. Yeah. So I've got fairly good military knowledge, and in two services, which is a little bit special.
It is.
The CFA, of course, is a long running and current theme. I'm an officer in one of the brigades now, and have
yes,
been
ma'am.
For a few years. And I've also served on the CFA board, so I understand it from the top right down to the well, fire, coal, it's not the coal face, the hot fire face, if you like.
Yeah. Well, that's, that, I mean, you know, and again, I've said it three times now, but I do sincerely mean it, Twinta. Thank you for you. Thank you for your service, both, you know, military and, you know, voluntary, because people don't recognise. And got to remember that we're streaming right across around the world here on TNT Radio. And thank you to all our wonderful listeners too. But, you know, people don't understand that the Country Fire Authority is a voluntary fire service right across the state of Victoria. And, of course, there are other country fire authorities in other states too. And the volunteers do a magic job. I've been watching, you know, the floods right now with the SES and the volunteers in there. You know, we're very fortunate in this country that we have so many wonderful people who are prepared to commit themselves to serving the community. I know this is taking away from the organizational behavior, but I think it's important that, you know, our listeners get to know people like you and the service that our people do that volunteer.
It's extremely important. And when one realises this, the Country Fire Authority has around 50,000 volunteers across the state of Victoria. It's not a small organisation. And with the recent changes to the way emergency services have been organised in Victoria, there's been a split off of what were full-time employed firefighters, and now CFA is really wholly volunteer. As far as the firefighting operation goes, there are, of course, paid people centrally to keep the whole organisation running, but the people who turn up to fight the fires are volunteers. And they are exceptional, of course. And many have been there. It's quite a tradition within CFA. Many have been there for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 and plus years. It's yes, quite an extraordinary thing.
No, and again, you know, it's just amazing. But that's a subject that we could talk about probably for the next hour. But I'm going to take us back to the subject matter that we do want to talk about and devote a bit of time to this afternoon. And that's the question on organizational behavior, coaching managers to apply simple but powerful organizational principles in their enterprise. So what are we actually talking about and how can we do this?
Well, what I'm interested in, because I have as you've gathered with all the bio and the touching on a couple of the organisations I've been involved with through my life, I'm quite intrigued by how organisations organise themselves, both small and large. And I've also been involved at board level in a few organisations, so I can get a very good insight, both in the private sector and the public sector, how they approach problems and the mental set, if you like, that they have when problems arise. And what I've found is that there's quite typical perspectives that you can perceive in the way management looks at problems and maybe why they end up with the kinds of solutions to those problems that they do. One example being, and you'd probably quite like this, Sam, that when a problem looks tough, I think the assumption very often in management is that the solution must be expensive.
Yeah, so true, so true. I mean, in the number of roles that I've played with different departments, and although my bio isn't as interesting as yours, however, yeah, you're right. It always comes down to if it's too expensive, then it's too hard to do also.
That's right. It can look very daunting. And yes, so it may be a case that we get stuck with the problem and just keep persisting because we think it's going to be very expensive. But that doesn't necessarily follow. Just because a problem looks tough does not mean that the solution is automatically expensive.
Yeah.
And I have a particular little phrase that I like to emphasise with problem solving, and that is to seek the either no cost or low cost variety of solution. And that's sometimes a revelation. And to have that as a mantra when there's problem solving at the managerial level, and it should flow down to the worker as well. Workers can sometimes catch that attitude, if you like, from management when problems come up. But in fact, some solutions can be no cost or low cost.
That's right. And sometimes it's about how you're engaged too. And it really gets me to think about that sometimes, although the problem is a difficult problem and it might be costly, what management tends to do is to say, well, the problem is the staff member or the staff or the employees. If we do a restructuring, if we do something, that's going to get rid of the problem, without really looking internally about that the problem is, in some cases, is not just about employees. It's about the way that managers have managed their employees.
Oh, yes, very, very much so. One workplace that I went and did some consulting with had some difficulties in their sort of the dispatch area, where there was workflow within the food manufacturing organisation, and they had to liaise their food manufacturing area with the dispatching and loading area. And they had some difficulties with rostering and so on. And they... a lot of the difficulty revolved around people just really not being aware of the workflow and where things came from and where things went to. And a really low-cost solution was to install a whiteboard where they could display the workflow so everyone could see it and have it be updated in real time. So that's an example of a, you know, very low-cost solution to help people with that bewildering position that they end up in. You know, I don't know when this stuff is going to be arriving and how much it is and where it's going to go. Well, can we try a whiteboard?
it's such a simple solution when you think about it. I mean, I was thinking about the saga many years ago about the whiteboard saga in Parliament, and that was so funny. But this is such an easy solution, isn't it? And you've got to say to yourself, sometimes managers also do make the solutions difficult for themselves, because they don't know how to organize themselves and how to react and how to look at it in a simplest way.
That's right. That's right. And when a problem, as I said, seems tricky or tough and the solution just doesn't drop into their lap, they can often think that the answer is going to be expensive. Another interesting little mantra that I like to play out too is to look inside the box rather than outside the box, which is something we've been we've thrown around for a few decades now. But I think in many cases, when we've looked outside the box for solutions and for ideas, we have often thrown the baby out with the bathwater, for another cliche, when we fail to look inside the box. And we can unpack that one, excuse the pun or deliberate pun, a little bit more too. So inside the box is sometimes where the solution can lie.
Yeah, and that's so true. So some of the examples, I mean, like you've just spoken about with the whiteboard, what are some of the other solutions that management or managers can do that are very simple?
Well, sometimes it's a case of having employees talk. Well, workflow is a very important one. So having employees talk about where their bottlenecks are. It may not be a restructure that's necessary. It might be a particular piece of equipment that's not working well. It might be procedures that are published that don't work well for that location and need to be adapted to that location, rather than be a template, say in a just geographically distributed organisation where there's multiple branches. You know, you often policies and procedures are centralised and rolled out to all the branches, so there's consistency. But this doesn't always match with the local methods of doing things, because in the local area, perhaps accessing an external resource might be just too far, so they have to access a different kind of resource. Or it might be just you've got to plug in different names. Don't have to contact someone who's halfway around the country. Contact someone locally. There's lots of things inside the box that can be done, and you don't need to bring in a solution, proprietary solution from overseas, the next best thing, when in fact there could be quite important things locally, which will get to another little one of the mantras in a moment.
Sure. And we'll be right back on TNT Radio. My special guest this afternoon is Tunde Mikkel, and a psychologist, and we're talking about organizational behavior here on TNT Radio. So we're just going to go over for a quick break.
You should hear what Mike Ryan's talking about.
In California, the AB 2098 bill sealed the fate of Californians. That's when it says doctors are not allowed to basically take care of the patients unless it's sanctioned by the state, the state being the state of California. There's no chance of discourse with doctors or providers on the pandemic. The risks are too high to engage in discussion. Under the new rubric, the doctor no longer serves the best interest of the patient, but acts as an agent of the state policy. When governments start practicing medicine, the story never ends well. And you look at Australia, Victoria, New South, Queensland, the whole lot of the country. If you come out, if you're a doctor or a medical professional and you act professional, then you're going to be jumped on, squashed, squished and dissected into little bits by the government and its proxies such as the TGA and ARPRA, and along with the other state governments who will do all they can to shut you up.
Mike Ryan on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of posts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
On air and on the app.
I listen on the app.
Stay up to date around the clock.
I listen, therefore I know.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Back on TNT with Mind Medicine. I'm Sam Muscat, standing in for Charles Covis, and like I said at the very beginning, some huge shoes that I've got to fill in for the next hour and a half. So my special guest this afternoon is Tunde Mikkel, a psychologist who lives in Ballarat, a region in Victoria. If you haven't been to Ballarat, it's a beautiful part of Melbourne and a historical part of Melbourne too. It's the Eureka Stockade, a mining town. It has some very colourful history. And I'm a little bit close to Ballarat in the sense because of my union background, but not here to talk about that. Here to talk about organizational behavior and how do we coach managers to apply simply by putting their powerful organization principles into their enterprise. Tunde, we just finished off with, you know, a couple of ways of going through how managers can simply do powerful organizational and use their skills, simply like you said, put a whiteboard up. But what are some of the other things? Because what I have found in my time dealing with managers in, you know, my time as a union official, as a state secretary of one of the biggest unions in the country, I used to think that managers didn't really understand their people and they didn't communicate well with their people. And I think from a coaching perspective and organizational behavior perspective, there's some of the things that really need and should have, in the times that I was around, would have helped managers to be able to manage better, to understand their workforce better. And from a productivity, they could have got much more out of their employees only if they listened. So is this part of the organizational behavior?
Well, yes, it does. Absolutely is, Sam. You know, that would be an example of looking inside the box.
Yes.
You know, very often, as you say, employers don't really know much about the full resource that they've got in the people that they hire. They have a very narrow view of what an employee can do for them and do with them. And when they start speaking to people and actually exploring them a bit further beyond the job description, the narrow job description, they discover that people very often have many strings to their bow, have many other capacities that they could be exploiting. And it's a two-way street, Sam. Sometimes those employees with those other attributes, those other really valuable personal resources that they could contribute are being wasted, and those folks move on. You know, those folks leave, you know, when they're not being fully utilised and being encouraged to fully engage with the workplace.
So, you know, Tunde, when you've gone out to do some of this training with managers in different businesses, what's the reaction that you get when you first go in to talk to them about coaching them, really coaching them on how to be, in simple terms, to be a better manager?
Well, sometimes there's a perspective that because they've been in their workplace for a long time, they really feel like they can't be taught new tricks. As another example, which of course I'm not doing. I'm trying to harness what they probably actually do, but it may not be in the workplace. They may, in fact, do these things as a sports coach. They may do these in their volunteer organisation. But oddly, sometimes those skills and those perspectives don't translate to their workplace because of the commercial nature of the environment.
Well, see, I was just going to say, is it because of the commercial environment, or is it because there's rules and regulations? No, better still, that there are policies and procedures within a workplace that maybe a manager can't be so much like a coach, in a sense?
To some extent, there'd be things that limit some of these because of accountability.
Yeah.
People perceive that they don't want to be where the buck stops. I've got lots of cliches today. They don't want to be the one to be the accountable person, the origin of ideas, or the one responsible for a way of doing things. They would rather have someone from outside or a program from outside to be used to do things rather than either do it themselves or have people internally do them, because that way someone else is accountable. Now, this is a very common thing.
So, Tunde, then let's walk through an example, right? So you've been invited. So an organisation has called you. What do they normally say to you when it comes around organisational behaviour? Just give us one example of, and you don't have to, when we're not naming the organisation, but one that you were called for specifically on organisational behaviour.
I mean, one simple example was a place that I was actually responsible for. I was working within and also consulting too. So, you know, the role was a senior administrator, and it was to establish administrative systems within the organisation related to their academic enterprise.
Okay.
And so it was very ad hoc. It had been patched together and cobbled together, been running for a few years, but it was now on the threshold of needing to make major change, partly as a response to regulatory change, and which is often what happens in organisations, that the regulations related to their work, whatever enterprise they're in, changes, new laws come out, and the organisation now has to respond and ship-shape everything to fit those new regulations,
boxes. This wasn't to improve productivity then?
Well, ultimately it does. It does, but it also interferes with it. And so this organisation was an international one and also multiple states and, you know, multiple campuses.
Yes.
And so it had to create the systems. And one principle that I applied there was one effort, multiple uses. So we had to look very carefully at the reporting requirements, because one of the things that people suffer from when new systems are in place or onerous systems, especially in response to regulation, is an excess of time spent on reporting.
Okay.
Yeah, so reporting at a low level, then that reporting at the next level, and then more reports further. And in many organisations, they treat these separate reports as separate reports. When you think of the number of hours in a person's day, if they have to create a new report for every committee and every level that they're responding to, that is a lot of time, and people get very burnt out. That's why people partly get burnt out with meetings, because they have to create a whole new set of reports for each meeting. Okay. So it's a pretty simple principle. Write one report that will deal with the most meetings that you cover, and then you can present that at a range of meetings. It seems like a no-brainer, but
is that difficult? Because
It seems like it shouldn't need to be something suggested, but you do have to suggest it. Otherwise, people will relate to each different level as a different report. So that one effort, multiple uses, and that's for example with reporting, with the use of documents and templates. So to come up with consistent templates, so you do it once and then it can be rolled out over multiple different documents. These are at the systems level.
So you were called in to look at this.
Yeah.
Because there were some changes within, I'm going to suggest, government, because it sounded like an educational institution.
Yes.
There was change with government policies, and it was how do we cope with these government policies to meet the requirements, the new requirements. Mm-hmm. So you had to go in then and speak to managers in regards to this.
Yeah.
And this was to get the outcomes of, as you've just said now, of maybe putting out, instead of multiple reports, a report.
Yes, yeah, so the aim is to have people, because they had a small staff, they couldn't just throw more people at the problem. With high load, work demands, so their time is limited, they are getting threatening to be overworked and burnt out with these extra requirements. And so it was essential that they had a more efficient, streamlined set of systems to work within that was sustainable. And so given all that, with a small number of people, it was vital that there were suggestions and streamlining that would work for them, which really at the end of the day attends to something about which I am passionate, which is human-centered design. And in organisations where humans are working, which is a lot of them, still,
yes,
one day it might not be, we need to think of systems in place designed around people and what people are likely to do given no guidance, and then how we would like things to turn out and where we are best targeting the programs, policies, procedures, so that we get the outcomes that the organization needs or thinks it needs anyway at that time.
So in this case, you're talking to managers to get them ready for the change that's required because of policy and procedure.
Yeah. For example, if regulation requires that you demonstrate that you've been doing consultation, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, your documentation has to show somewhere in it that you've been doing consultation. So you have to keep records of your consultations, who's been attending, when, for how long, what were the outcomes, what were the inputs, what were the outputs, what was the purpose. That's all captured. And then reference to that can be made in other documents, and that set of documents about consultation can be reused and referred to by a number of different reports. So the format for that capture is really quite important because it's a set of knowledge and data. And then the documents which are part of your governance, compliance, regulatory reporting documents tick off all the boxes on which you have to report to make sure you've included all of those. And it's really, really easy then at reporting time to go back through your documents, because they all have sections within them that speak to the regulatory requirements and the box ticking that needs to happen for the regulator. What was happening prior to all of this was people were thrown at the job of reporting time, and countless 24-hour days were spent by people trawling through phenomenal amounts of random reports to gather information and evidence. Really terrible.
Yeah, and it would have been. And it's messy and it's not clear then.
No.
And, you know, so there's a fair bit of mental health issues in regards to because of the pressure that's put onto me when you're dealing with them.
Yes.
So in your deliberations then, what else are you coaching them to do?
Well, sometimes, actually, another phase of working with businesses was during the bushfire recovery time. And a lot of businesses struggled, of course, because their cash flow was disrupted. And not only were they suffering personal impact by the major bushfires, this is the 2019-2020 fires in particular. Wow. And they may have had a home which was destroyed. Their business might have been impacted directly. Their business may have been destroyed. And so their journey to recovery involved a lot of personal mental health coaching to ensure that they were able to embrace the resources that were becoming available for them. And part of resilience and building resilience is to assist people to seek and use the resources around them because they're traumatized.
Yes.
You know, these folks are traumatized. And so doing that, playing a part there, and also then to be able to be the person who's not affected, who can then help them identify ways forward, steps forward, little steps even, that they can constructively take to rebuild their business, perhaps change the direction, which may be no longer relevant for them. Now they need to change tack, and the different organisations that they can contact. So being a resource as well is part of the process. But when you're working with problems with mental health, a lot of the time it's to support and build the resilience of people who are in crisis.
Yeah, I segued into that on purpose because I was thinking that when you're talking about, and I'm going back to the organisational behaviour stuff and thinking about making changes in the workplace, because that example that you've given is there had to be a change because all of a sudden the requirements from government talked about a way that you had to do a reporting process. And you've also encapsulated the fact that instead of doing a dozen reports, you could do maybe one report that encapsulated everything that you needed to report on. And I was thinking the pressure on those managements to change their ways, because they might have been doing it for a long period of time. And of course, engaging managers to accept that they needed to change. And then for those managers, even with a small group of employees, for those managers then to be able to take it down to that level and say why we need to do this and all that. So I could just see the pressure on individuals. And I suppose it really doesn't matter if it's a small business or a big business or a small institution or a huge institution. It's the pressure that it applies to people and how that could automatically turn into mental health issue and all sorts of other issues. Hence the reason why I asked that, because I just think that, you know, when you go out to coach managers to make these powerful organizational changes or to use the principles in their enterprise, sometimes that's a lot of pressure on managers.
To make those changes?
Yeah.
Well, they're having to make changes anyway. I think that's probably the situation, you know. So you're not fixing something that's not broken. Something's broken.
Yes,
when you come in anyway. So they do need to be responding. There's not nudging people at a time of tranquility. You know, when things are working well, that's fine and dandy. They're not going to be looking for solutions. It's when there's problems that they're looking for solutions. And the difficulty generally is that because of the natural biases people have, because of the general default way of thinking, as I said, looking outside the box, when in fact the resources might be sitting right next to them, you know, the perception that if a problem is complex, gee, it's going to take a long time and it's going to be expensive to fix, you know, so they'll be expecting major hurdles when in fact it might be as simple as a whiteboard. When they're looking at systems, or when they're looking at responses to changing environmental circumstances, whatever that might be, whether that's regulations, whether that's changes of supply lines, whether that's changes in the marketplace for customers, you know, the different expectations customers have got, the notion that these things will be either unsolvable or there's not an ability to look at both the system as well as the coal face. Okay. Some people are really good systems thinkers. Some people are really good at the coal face, the small things. It's like seeing the forest and the trees. Some people are great at identifying the trees. Other people are great at looking at the forest, but not everybody's good at both.
No, and that's true too. We'll be right back. This is TNT Radio, and I'm standing in for Charles Kovas, and I'm Sam Muscat with Mind Matters.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
And right on cue, leftist media working hard to earn their paycheck as the propaganda arm of the Democrat Party are trying to turn Hurricane Ian into Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's Katrina moment 1 month before the general election. But if a viral video of one Arcadia, Florida man is any indication, their plans might not go as expected. The man and his friend were so happy that a gas tanker had pulled up in Arcadia that he said, "I'm a Democrat and I'm voting for Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis got us the gas." And that's what politics is really about. That's what Tip O'Neill meant when he said all politics is local. If a politician isn't taking care of the people, it's time for the people to change politicians. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
You only put your son to bed 1 hour ago and he's woken up saying his tummy really hurts and he's got a temperature. You're worried. The 111 person you normally speak to isn't available. The surgery's closed. It's not an emergency, but you're not sure what to do. Then you remember the new free 24-hour NHS number, 111. They assess you and direct you straight away to the medical help you need. Your 111 relieved mum.
If it's not a 999 emergency but you need medical help fast, there's now 111 number to call. When it's less urgent than 999, call 111. Now available on the Isle of Wight.
Brian Stelter and Liz Cheney gone in the same week.
And that's just the start of draining the entire swamp.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And you're on Mind Medicine with Sam Muscat standing in for Charles Kovas. And my special guest this afternoon is Tunde Mikel. And Tunde, we've just been having a great conversation in regards to organizational behavior. Really simply put, how do you then engage them to look at powerful organizational principles? What are some of those principles?
Well, I've already now talked about sort of no-cost and low-cost perspectives, and that's quite an overarching sort of thing to look for. It's quite tough sometimes for people to think that really, it might be a case of turning left rather than right when you do something. You know, it could be really quite a simple solution to a problem that's arisen. It could be things also like looking inside the box, looking at the people that you've got and the resource that are there, the equipment that you've got, the systems that you've got, the existing products that you've got, rather than thinking you've got to go out and pay a lot of money for an outside solution, which is, you know, maybe not the case. And sometimes the issue of designing out the problems, if you've got the opportunity to intervene at the systems level, figure out whether you can actually avoid the problems in the first place by introducing human-centered design, which is acknowledging, gosh, you know, I'm dealing with people. What are people likely to do in this situation? Are they likely to put the widget in the right hole, the round peg in the round hole, if I don't tell them to? or if I don't show them that the round peg has to go in the round hole, what might they do? They might take a lot of time experimenting with the pieces if I don't show them. So maybe engineering out some problems might be good, doing good training, for example.
Do you find, do you find then you could get them to engage better with their employees, or do you get their employees to come in and be a part of the conversation when they're talking about organizational behavior?
Well, it's a very interesting thing you ask, that I think it's essential that there's be conversations with the employees as well as managers. Often it'll be managers that obviously, because it's their task to engage with someone to do this sort of consultation. It won't be workers that will take that initiative. But it's a very interesting question, because you've touched on something I wasn't planning on segueing to today, and we might do this another time. And that's all about the question of how do you consult well in organisations?
Yes.
And that's an entire, like a thesis almost we could do on that one, because a lot of the time what employers will do is send out a survey or ask, do a focus group or ask a few people or walk around the shop floor and get the vibe, you know, and they think they've consulted with people and got an idea of what's going on. And well, that goes some way to, you know, achieving this. But at the end of the day, there's quite a lot of finesse that has to happen between doing that and then incorporating it into your policies and procedures.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that that is so crucial. And you're right, it is another subject. But I suppose what I was thinking of is that when you start talking about organisational behaviour, I'm thinking about, like you said before, or very early in the piece, about processes and procedures and the manufacturing processes and procedures and being more efficient and making those changes so that we can be more efficient. I was just wondering then, how do you, and I've come back to this again and again, how do you then engage with your workforce to get them to make those and to accept those, in a sense, powerful ongoing principles in their enterprise, which means that you've actually coached the managers to make the organisational changes?
Well, it's workers will often, to support that idea of talking to the workers, workers will often highlight a problem, but often be stuck with the solution. They can be assisted in helping to create the solution, especially if we've taken a human-centred engineering design perspective, because if we do that, then we're actually asking the workers, what will help you do this better or more accurately or more efficiently? And workers often have a good idea of what will help them. And when people are actually offered things which they do actually think will help them, they're actually going to try it. You know, there's no real resistance there. Resistance tends to come, if there is that, when an external solution is imposed upon an organisation.
Yeah.
You know, and some organisations bring in those external solutions with a lot of bells and whistles. I have to sort of say that one large organisation I have been associated with for a very long time purchases and has done for, gosh, about 10 years, a product from overseas, which is suited to team building, but in the military. Its origins are military team building. Now, the organisation it's applied to is not military, although some people might think it might be a little bit, but it really doesn't translate well to the organisation it's applied to here. And yet it's enjoyable, it's got bells and whistles, people feel like it's attractive, but it does not actually produce the goods that it's being paid to do. It's not producing the goods. So, but because it's enjoyable, people keep doing it. And it's really rather a waste of money. There would be probably better, the money would be better invested in developing an in-house program that is suited to the organisation and its particular way of working rather than purchasing one from overseas. So that would be an example But there, because it's enjoyable, people don't want to let go of the bells and whistles. There are some things that people are very attached to.
So, you know, in the time, yeah, that's interesting. You know what? I could have easily gone into another subject just then, but I had to bite my tongue a little there. you know, because we don't have much more time,
but yeah.
On organisational behaviour, what's been the positive results when you've had to then talk to managers and get them to realise that, you know, there are tools that they can use at their disposal and they can be better productive? What's been the outcomes?
Well, after a period of exploration with them, generally speaking, there's quite a lot of joy, should I say, you know, really quite a lot of happiness that they are in fact probably more than likely capable of sourcing and implementing the changes necessary, because they're not necessarily extraordinarily expensive, complex, remote. People kind of generally at the end of the day know what they need. In fact, it's interesting, Sam, that perspective comes from Rogerian, Carl Rogers, and the humanist tradition within psychology. That perspective is that people really at the heart know what they need to change in themselves or their environment to heal.
Okay.
All right. So I cut my teeth in psychology on that area of perspective, that area of theory, if you like, about behaviour. And so I'm very much about, I don't like the term, it's a bit overused, but empowering people, helping them see, should I say, informing them, enlightening them about the capacities that they actually do have and how accessible this is for them to do. And the simple tools that they can employ to source those things, by, as you say, Sam, simply talking to people, but in a problem-solving way. Not coming up with a solution and then imposing it upon your workers, but collegially working on what things people have discovered. Are the blockages? Where are the problems? What's not working? And together finding the solution.
So are you saying, Tunda, that then people get to this realisation that, geez, I've actually got the skill to do this?
Yes.
And it's almost like it must be like a sigh of relief.
It is a sigh of relief. And that if they do get someone to come in to speak to them, that person should be more of a coach rather than a fount of all knowledge, you know, to impose a solution. Here it is, pull one out of my pocket and lay it on the table. Well, that's not really what should be happening.
No, and that's one of the things that I've always enjoyed about talking with you, is that you're always talking about coaching. It's not about telling, it's about coaching. And then out of that, I think there becomes a realization within oneself to say, hold on a minute, I knew all about this. It didn't click. You know, it's like that penny drops, since you want to throw all these cliches, that penny drops and you go, there it is.
Exactly. And as I've said, you know, earlier, very often people are doing some of these things in other places. Yes. They might be doing it in their home life. They might be doing it in their sports club or in their church or, you know, wherever they are involved elsewhere. They might have a different relationship to the problem-solving space, and they might feel comfortable doing these sorts of collegiate problem-solving. But in the commercial space, it just switches on a different part of their being and they lose that sense of autonomy and confidence that they really ought to have.
Is that the real key issue? Is it that they lose their, and I sometimes jokingly say their mojo, but it's got nothing to do with their mojo. Is it that they lose the, I can't think of it now, but it's almost like you lose the fact of having to think for yourself.
Yes, accountability is a scary thing. So sometimes people are discouraged from taking these initiatives. But at the end of the day, people can be made safe in their role to be able to go down this path of problem solving, taking initiatives, doing analysis, doing their internal research, and suggesting improvements, incremental improvements, quite readily, and feeling safe about that because they're documenting things, which is one of the other things we could talk about perhaps another time, and that is capturing knowledge as you go. And so if they are doing this, then there's really no vulnerability that's exposed, you know, because people are doing this in a sound fashion. They didn't just have a brain bubble that, you know, occurred to them that morning.
Yeah, because it's like when you said if a person, you know, outside of their work life is a coach, you know, they're taking a heap of responsibilities, although it's different. But then you'll find that they come to work and they're not as engaging because they've got to follow a particular process or a particular policy or procedure. And they're too frightened to speak out and say, well, I need to make a change here because this is not right.
Yes, that's right. And indeed, when you are then now part of a team, there is a phenomenon such as sort of freeloading, you know, you know, it's shared responsibility. What can I do? There's a whole bunch of people. I'm only one. I can't do much. Or it can be, well, it's ticking along. It's not great. But look, I'll just kick the problem upstairs. You know?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I can see that happening. And I was walking through my life's experience, you know, from an industrial relations specialist in some of the organizations that I've worked. And you're right. You know, sometimes it's about, well, you know what? It's really not my problem. These are the rules that I've been given, or these are the perimeters. This is what it is. And you tend to not want to go that extra mile, do you?
No, it can be very discouraging. But being frank at the end of the day, Sam, another whole box, a can of worms, or, you know, a box to unpack would be the worker or the human job fit. And if you come to this sort of point of enlightenment where you really do have some good ideas, you really do know how the place could work better, and wherever the action linchpin of executing these plans is a blockage, like top management just not willing to listen to the analysis. Let's say you're a middle manager, for argument's sake, and you're trying to work with your operational team, then at the end of the day, maybe it's not a good person job fit.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that sentiment at the end, because sometimes, you know, me personally, and it's not about me, but I know that I've gone in to say we need to change this and here's the solution, not just the problem. And you get cut off because it's got to go to the board, or it's got to go here, or it's got to go there, you know?
Yes. And that's extremely discouraging. And I'm not suggesting that there's always an automatic uptake of these suggestions. But what is very obvious is that there's very little hesitation for a flow down from the top imposition of changes. That's very much the case. And there's often almost no explanation given to people below the C-suite as to why those changes have been made in that way and how they arrived at them, as opposed to some other method, which would be more human-centered, for example. Lots of boxes to unpack here, Sam.
Well, Tunde, I just want to say thanks again. And you are going to join me after the hour at 5 o'clock, after the news too. So I really appreciate your time this afternoon. And your contribution has been fantastic, and I'm looking forward to the next subject we're going to talk about. You're with Mind Medicine, and this is Sam Muscat standing in for Charlie Kovas on TNT Radio, and this is TNT Radio. Stay tuned, because we'll probably be going across to the news and then coming back to having another chat on another subject with Tunde Mikkel, who's a psychologist, and she's been doing a great job entertaining us this afternoon, Tunde. So thank you so much. And just don't forget, folks, that you can also listen to Charlie Kovas every second Saturday from 4 o'clock till 6 o'clock. That's Melbourne time. And yeah, that's a bit of a joke that I've got to say to you later on. And it's Mind Medicine, and he has some really fantastic guests, and he's a hard act to follow, I've got to say, but I'm trying my best.